First case is A23-1944, appellant Scott Marlon Morey versus respondent State of Minnesota.
All right, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Bo McGraw. May it please counsel as well. My name is Bo McGraw. I represent Mr. Morey. We are here on an appeal from a denial of post-conviction relief petition. At the outset, how I want to get this started is I want to challenge Your Honors to think in terms of the totality of the circumstances, if we might, in this case. Counsel is making the argument that we're time barred based on all of these various circumstances that existed in this case. And I would just challenge you to think in terms of the totality, and then we'll come back to the time barring argument. This is a situation where Mr. Morey was convicted of 13 counts of criminal sexual conduct related to two individuals that were in his care, his adopted children. They went by the initials of FM and EM. Your Honor, Mr. Morey has brought forward in his petition claims that I think are extraordinary, and it relates to the administration of his case and the administration of justice generally. Let's first start with his own attorney. This is by way of background. He filed a previous post-conviction relief motion as it relates to that, but it's related to this case in this way. During the course of his case prior to the matter going to trial, EM, who was one of the complaining witnesses in the case, had taken his life prior to the trial. He passed as a young 15-year-old boy, but prior to him taking his life, he had came to my client's significant other, his wife, Monica, and reported that he had made up these allegations of sexual violence. And in fact, he then also conveyed that same message to a third-party witness we've identified in the brief. My client's wife then brought that information to the attention of Mr. Morey's attorney at the time. It was 3 weeks prior to EM taking his own life. She also brought this information, and this is important to this petition, to the social workers that were assigned to the case at the time. The reason it's important is, first of all, these children were not in my client's care any longer. He was in custody waiting trial, and the children were not in his wife's care either. They were in the exclusive care of social services. She brought this to their attention, asked that it be investigated. Okay, that's where that piece was left. She also asked that his attorney investigate that claim. And we know from the previous post-conviction relief petition that it's Mr. Morey's contention that that was not properly investigated. Okay, so how does that relate to this case? That's just the first piece of the puzzle that just doesn't add up here, in that this case wasn't handled properly. Then what do we have? When these claims come forward, Your Honors, these claims of sexual violence to these children first come forward to an individual who, by the name of Neil Dolan. Neil Dolan's relationship to this case was he was the primary investigator of the case, but he went a bit beyond that. It's different than what we're accustomed to. He was also the police officer that was assigned to the school where FM and EM went to school. He testified during the course of the trial, and we lay this out in the brief, that he had familiarity with FM and EM, and I think he even testified that he had frequent interaction with them. Defense counsel tried to pin him down as to how frequent that interaction was, and we know that it was at least multiple times per month. What do we know about
there, Mr. McGraw? I think there's a deficiency, though, in your submissions. Don't you need to show that the dates or times when your client became aware of what happened with Dolly and what surrounded that? I mean, how do we know what the time point was when that discovery, if you will call it, was made?
And I think that that's an important part of your analysis here. I don't have any doubt from that, and I'm not hiding from that. I think that's something that could probably come out properly at a hearing when a client's under oath and he can testify about these things. But if we just look at what was available in the public record, we know this. We know that this primary investigator was charged with and convicted of and pled guilty to 6 crimes regarding sexual violence to minors. First degree cases, second degree cases, and 1/3 degree case. He was sentenced to a significant prison sentence, and he's going to serve time until the year of 2041. Okay, we know that my client didn't have any awareness of that during the course of his underlying criminal case. We know that at this point. We also know that this lead investigator, who held this unique position in a small town, admitted under oath that he had contact with these two alleged victims in this case. We can suspect, based upon his criminal cases, that his contact with the individuals that he pled guilty to or otherwise convicted of victimizing occurred. We know it occurred at the school. We know that he brought these individuals into his safe office at the school, and he victimized them there. And we know that he threatened them with family violence if they reported. So we know that we had this really rogue police officer investigating crimes of sexual violence for a person that was facing trial of a crime for sexual violence. So let's just talk about this one piece if we can, if I can connect another dot here on this totality of the circumstances. If we go back to the first part of my argument where we talk about the information coming from my client's wife, Monica, to Mr. Lunig, and then to the social worker about EM's recantation. My client has a right to have a hearing to determine what, if anything, Mr. Dolan did to investigate that. Whether or not social services brought him any information as it relates to that recantation, and what, if anything, he did to investigate that. In light of his criminality, that's an important analysis if we look at the administration of justice and fundamental fairness as it relates to Mr. Morey. Now let's talk about the next piece here. So we have allegations regarding my client's criminal defense attorney that they fell short. Mr. Lunig, it's my client's position that they fell short on this piece that we've laid out.
Okay, also on that one, on counsel, that all occurred 2 years after the petition for post-conviction relief that was already filed. So that's the hurdle you have to get over. And the same thing as far as Dolan, and it's reprehensible in terms of what was discovered and what came out. But again, we look at this through that Times lens, and I don't know how you can get us over that lens. And I wish you would talk more about that, how we can characterize this as newly discovered evidence when we don't have a time frame.
Yeah, and that's important, Your Honor. I know that. The rules allow for us to not entirely focus on that, though, if the circumstances justify it. If we look at this, and the reason I keep talking about the totality of the circumstances, if we just looked at this piece with Mr. Lunig and the failure to properly investigate this recantation when there was purportedly promises, my client testified that his attorney was going to do that. Is that enough to get a new trial? I don't know. Maybe not. If we look at Neil Dolan's crimes, is that of itself, is that just enough? There's not claims that he committed sexual violence as it relates to the two alleged victims of this case. Is that just enough?
All right. Now do you have any case law at all that you can point us to that would support that? Because the judge in this case said, look, these are other kids. These were not the same kids that were involved. Is there anything out there in the bigger world that we should be aware of?
I don't know of anything specifically. And if I did, I certainly would have put it in this brief. We put a lot of care and effort into this brief to make sure we'd give you the best information we could. I'm challenging you to think in terms of all of this. And if we look at this, is this the way we do things in our system of justice? We got a failure to investigate by the attorney. We have this criminality by the lead investigator interacting with these children at school. Then we got this second piece. Okay. Now here's the turn for me. It's my client's wife reporting to social services that there's this recantation, okay? We don't know what social services, if anything, did with that. We know that Dolan was compromised because of his own criminality, likely, but we also have another piece here, which I don't want to be too hyperbolic, but this has the feel to like a John Grisham book without the race component. We've got an investigator that has problems, and now we're introducing an attorney that has problems. And it's not an attorney that has problems that wouldn't otherwise be related to the administration of justice. It's an attorney that had problems as it related to providing, based on my knowledge of it, providing what would otherwise be exculpatory information in the prosecution of a defendant in a criminal case. I think it was a narcotics case. And the allegation was that he failed to turn over evidence that was exculpatory in nature. We have a direct information that's brought that there's exculpatory evidence here. There's not an investigation done. At least there's not a record whereby we know whether or not there was an investigation done. And then we have a prosecutor that has some history. It sounds like there was one infraction. I don't know if there's others. Some history. So I'm trying to be as fair as I can. But this is important stuff when you don't turn over evidence in criminal cases. And so all of those pieces as they fit together here, we have to hold that up to what we aspire to have as a system of justice. And is that with that many errors in a case, that many connection to bad acts, is this the kind of conviction that we can all feel proud of? The rules allow for you.
Mr. McGraw, so with the NAFLA bar, there's the 2-year period of time, and then there's those two exceptions, that being that the claim is so novel that the legal basis was not reasonably available, or when fairness requires and the petitioner did not deliberately and inexcusably fail to raise the issue. It seems to me, or are you indicating that all of this together is either such a novel claim that the court should disregard the 2-year time bar, or are you saying that fairness requires and then he did not deliberately and inexcusably fail to raise the issue on his previous appeal? And if so, going back to Judge Werke's question, how do we get over the timing of this? When did he know about the prosecutor's issues? When did he know about the conviction for the officer? And how do we address it in that manner?
Thank you, Your Honor. And good to appear in front of you this morning. The last time I saw you was in Ramsey County District Court. I think it fits under two of those. And when I said early, and I wasn't trying to be hyperbolic about a John Grisham book, this is the first time I've been practicing law for 22 years. This is the first time that I've seen these three issues that relate so much to not just kind of, you know, you see errors on cases and common things that happen, but just with bad actors involved and just bad acts. And we have to rely upon these people because they brought this case forward. They were the ones that, other than the district court judge, that we entrusted with the administration of justice, and they were given enormous power. And we don't know what they did with this information. There is not a record of that. I don't know if the social service worker went out and interviewed EM before he passed on, and there's something somewhere that would allow us to better understand whether or not there was a recantation. All it would take is a hearing for an hour for us to figure this out.
But counsel, when was that recantation made?
It was made prior to his trial, prior to 2016, Your Honor.
And so why wasn't this raised in the first post-conviction petition?
I don't know. I wasn't on that at that part of it. And I think, again, it comes more to this whole totality. I don't think in the first one, and certainly on my client's direct appeal, that he knew that Dolan had the issues that Dolan had.
No, and but then, the recantation issue, if you're trying to connect it to Dolan, that whole issue matters in terms of the timing. If they knew about it before trial, then it could have been raised on direct appeal. It could have been raised in ineffective assistance, first post-conviction, all of that. And we're here now on second post-conviction.
He did raise it on his first post-conviction, I believe, Your Honor. I'm trying to be as candid and honest as I can. I think he did raise it. My client represented himself. He brought a post-conviction relief petition claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. And I'm quite certain that he raised it in that context. But again, I think it's these other pieces. It's this totality of these pieces where, yeah, away from his ineffective assistance of counsel claim as it relates to his attorney. Did his attorney have an obligation to investigate that claim? I would submit certainly, okay? Whether or not that happened, I don't know. But when the evidence is that Monica, my client's wife, says that she brought it to the attention of social services, who are then serving as the mouthpiece because they're providing custody and control of these children, they had an obligation to contact law enforcement. I don't know if they did. The lead investigator would be Mr. Dolan, who would go out and take this report. We see supplemental reports on cases commonly as cases approach trial. He had an obligation here to go out and take that report. I don't know if he did. And then if he did take the report, because of the issues we have with the attorney that prosecuted the case and that history, I don't know if anything was ever turned over because it was exculpatory in nature. To get back to, and I'm running out of time here. I'm down to just 50 seconds or so, but when we get to the NAFLA bar, I do think that this case is so novel because of these issues. I just haven't seen it before. You guys see more of this than I do. I haven't seen it before. And then the second piece is there's people all the time that get new trials. There's people all the time that have hearings when we think that fairness requires. And those could be people that have been in prison for months. It could be people that have been in prison for years. And we allow them access to the courts if we don't think that the process was fair to them. Thinking in two things here. fundamental fairness as it relates to the defendant. The Constitution guarantees that. And then the second piece, which is important, is this perception in the public, this administration of justice. We fell short in both of those areas. We know now, based upon what has happened with these principal actors involved after my client's conviction. It's for these reasons that I simply ask that we go back and have a hearing in front of the district court judge so we can look at these circumstances to see whether or not they rise to the level of overturning Mr. Morey's conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, Ms. McGraw, if you go ahead and mute yourself, that'd be great. And then counsel for respondent, when you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Catherine Lorsbach. I'm the attorney for respondent and the Clearwater County attorney. I'd like to thank you first for having us here today. The respondent opines that the district court acted properly in summarily denying the appellant's petition for post-conviction relief. The appellant raised three issues in his petition. First, the letter from Dr. Nordahl, a general practitioner who reviewed appellant's correctional medical records from April 16th and 21st of 2020. Second, the conviction again or convictions against the investigating officer, Neil Dolan, for criminal sexual conduct. And then third, the disciplinary action by the Board of Professional Responsibility against former County Attorney Mullen from 2018 and 20. I would address these in order. However, I would just note for the court that as appellant noted in his district court petition and then was noted again in the court order, he stated that these were allegations concocted by a sexual predator police officer and a corrupt prosecutor who colluded in their efforts to falsely accuse Mr. Morey. So there's going to be some overlap in the second and third issue. And then I'd just like to briefly, before I get into those, address the statements of counsel raised at this hearing. So first of all, what we're hearing is a strong tie to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was previously raised at the first post-conviction appeal. And this court found that the trial counsel acted appropriately and that any decisions that were made were trial strategy. And so to bring that up, it isn't necessarily before the court, even if we're talking totality of the circumstances, that wasn't raised in the petition. An ineffective assistance of counsel claim wasn't again brought in this matter.
In the first matter, that also included the recantation. Is that correct?
I don't remember. I know that it specifically addressed the third party witness who was not called at the post-conviction relief hearing. The third party witness that Mr. McGraw noted that Mr. Morey's wife, Mrs. Morey, had spoken to. So I'm not certain if it was addressed entirely, but it was something that was raised in the petition, and then they didn't call that witness to testify at the trial or at the post-conviction hearing. So I think it was addressed, whether it was fully or just sort of collaterally. The court still found that Mr. Luning was not ineffective, and that any decisions that he made up to that point were trial strategy for the purposes of Mr. Morey's trial in district court. I would note that the incident with social services would have been 3 weeks before the horrible and a truly tragic suicide by one of the complaining witnesses. I believe that those counts ended up getting dismissed. So I think that that should be raised before this court as well, because there wasn't a witness to testify at trial. It was 3 weeks prior to the suicide, which predated trial. And as the parent to these children, Mr. Morey should have had access to the social service records. And so I think to say, you know, this is a totality of the circumstances, it just doesn't meet that time bar that would have been nearly 10 years ago at this point, that would have been raised. So I think that this could have been previously addressed. This could have been previously addressed on direct appeal, at trial with a continuance, on the first post-conviction relief. And there isn't any reason for us to go back at this point and try to engage in this fishing expedition. So to speak to the first issue that was brought, the letter from Dr. Nordahl, the court didn't err in summarily denying Mr. Morey's petition pursuant to Minnesota 590.04 subdivision 1. A district court may summarily deny a petition when the petition, files, and record conclusively show that the petitioner isn't entitled to relief. So Mr. Mori attempts to circumvent this two-year time limit about claims arising by saying that this is newly discovered evidence, but the court didn't accept it, and this court should affirm the findings of the district court. The letter was generated based on a routine medical examination from April 16th and 21st of 2020. The petition for post-conviction relief wasn't filed until September 28th of 2023. So even if this court were to entertain the petition, it's clear from language and statute that appellant hasn't met the requisite burden in this matter to necessitate even a hearing. The specific language of the statute notes that petitioner alleges that the existence of newly discovered evidence, including scientific evidence, that could not have been ascertained by exercise of due diligence by petitioner or petitioner's attorney within that two-year time period for filing. And the district court properly notes that this examination could have been conducted not only in that 2 years, but before trial and before that first post-conviction petition was filed. And a review of appellant's medical record by the doctor could have been obtained in a timely manner with due diligence, but it wasn't. So just for the sake of argument, even if the district court were to have found that the submission of these records was somehow not subject to this very clear time bar, the newly discovered evidence test clearly bars this letter from consideration. Prong 5 states that the evidence establishes by clear and convincing standard that the petitioner is innocent of the offenses for which he is convicted. This evidence isn't newly discovered, as I noted before, but it's truly the fifth prong of this test, which clearly bars any post-conviction relief. This evidence does not establish by clear and convincing standard that he is innocent of the offenses. In fact, a hearing isn't required if it could have been discovered earlier through due diligence, or if the district court finds, that when evidence is viewed even in the light most favorable to the petitioner, together with arguments of the parties, it conclusively shows petitioner is not entitled to relief. And I'm citing DeBlanche. And the doctor concedes in his letter that physical findings of a person obtained through a medical examination may or may not be evident to confirm an act of sexual assault for the alleged perpetrator or the victim. And the absence of these physical findings alone doesn't make an alleged assault impossible. However, the doctor suggests in clinical findings that they're not indicative of anything. In fact, he says that there's nothing in his examination that supports or relates to a past claim of sexual abuse. So clinical findings can be consistent and support allegations. However, they're not dispositive. So the district court viewed the evidence in light most favorable to appellant. However, found that appellant wasn't entitled to relief. So the court appropriately summarily denied the first claim. The second, with regard to Mr. Dolan, sorry, I have a cold. Former Deputy Dolan was convicted in district court in 2021 and 2022 of some truly heinous things. We are not contesting that. We don't argue it. But appellant submits in his petition. He submitted his petition for post-conviction relief in September of 2023. This case was highly publicized. Mr. Dolan drew both local and national attention for the duration of his proceedings, and several of the convictions would be time barred and outside of that two-year limitation. However, the court properly considered that this could be newly discovered evidence and conducted the appropriate analysis. So the court concluded that even though the evidence wasn't cumulative, it wasn't for impeachment purposes, it didn't establish by clear and convincing evidence that appellant is innocent of the offenses. The court properly concluded that Mr. Mori's theory for relief is that Mr. Dolan's convictions, which involved children that were not the children in question in this case, and Attorney Mullen's discipline matters, somehow suggest that Mr. Dolan and Mr. Mullen colluded in their effort to falsely accuse Mr. Mori of sexual abuse. And the court found that even if the matter had been timely, the theory was frivolous and doesn't reach the standard of clear and convincing evidence, which was appropriate because essentially what appellant asks us to ignore is the overwhelming evidence in this case, which includes appellant's own admissions at trial, the testimony of the victims, and then corroborating evidence where appellant speaks to a former sexual partner and explains to him how to groom his children. So that would be if we were to assume that Deputy Dolan at the time went to the county attorney and admitted that he had been sexually abusing children at the school. And the county attorney chose to ignore that. And then they picked a patsy, for lack of a better word. It just, even when viewed in light most favorable to the petitioner, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence. And so the court properly denied that portion of the petition. And then third, we get to Mr. Mullen's two complaints with the Office of Professional Responsibility. One is from 2018. It could have been raised with due diligence on the first post-conviction appeal. So the court did properly conclude that perhaps the 2020 opinion had not been available to appellant at the time of his post-conviction appeal, but still found that it didn't meet the burden for newly discovered evidence, that there isn't enough of a nexus connecting Mr. Mullen's completely unrelated disciplinary actions to this case. And so it's completely speculative, and it asks that the court essentially make these significant factual inferences that are completely out of line with the evidence that we've seen. And so the court did properly summarily deny this petition. And I would ask that this court find that Judge Schieferdecker acted appropriately in summarily denying this. Appellant was not entitled to a hearing. And for the most part, these claims are completely NAFLA barred and barred by statutory authority. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
And may it please the court, I do not have any further argument, and I'd otherwise rest on my initial argument and my brief, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Well, the case is submitted. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today and your briefs in this matter. And we will get an opinion issued within the statutory timeframe, and you are free to exit the Zoom.
Thank you.
You all.